I love the Doctor Who podcast, always seeing patterns in things that aren't there.
Hello everyone and welcome to episode 358 of the Doctor Who podcast. Once again with a slightly reduced attendance in the camper van, but it's always quality over quantity here. So I'm joined by Brent and Drew. Hello guys.
Hello.
Hello.
You are both fresh, well fresh-ish I suppose, from Long Island Who. And I'm very much looking forward to discussing that with you both shortly. However, there's a little bit of news to go through. Nothing monumental, given the fact that it's the height of summer and everybody seems to be on holiday, including everyone who's involved in the Doctor Who machine. But let's talk about a piece of news that took me by surprise. And Brent, I know this excited you, certainly. I'm not quite sure whether it's the story or whether it's just the fact that it's confirmation that the animation DVDs, Blu-rays are not dead. They are continuing. But The Underwater Menace will hit our virtual bookshelves and possibly our real-life bookshelves in some places very shortly.
Mm-hmm. From what I read, it's November. And yes, it's not the story. It's the fact that there's animation now. So maybe one day we can have a complete Doctor Who collection if you count the animations. What's different for this animated release that I noticed is that the color version and the black and white version are on the same disc. So, you know, they can save money that way. And the second disc has a ton of special features. It says there's a reconstruction of episodes 1 and 4. They have the original episodes 2 and 3. There's a making of documentary, Australian censor clips, different news reports, that sort of thing. There is one thing on here that I'm curious about. It's called The Man from Mididz. And I just looked that up. There was a show called The Midnight Men. And that was an episode with Patrick Troughton and Joseph First. So I don't know if it's the whole 30-minute episode or just the feature talking about it. I'm not sure.
Wow. Okay, that sounds like a bit of a stretch, really,
for
them. Nothing to do with Doctor Who at all, really,
all right.
but never mind. I mean, Drew, what are your thoughts of The Underwater Menace? Is this one of your favourite Second Doctor stories, and you're delighted it's coming out as an animated story?
I'm always going to be delighted if we get any kind of animation, because it's always a good chance to watch something that I wouldn't otherwise get a chance to. I like the story quite a bit. It's one of those that it was one of the harder target novelizations for me to hunt down. I got it at Long Island Who last time I was there, so I guess a year ago. So and read it, liked it quite a bit. So I'm excited to see what the story is like. What it is like to see the actual segmented parts. So.
Yeah.
The novelization is rarely the actual story, so we'll see.
Yeah. No, I'm interested in it as well this time. And two episodes exist in the transmitted version. So again, I suppose I'm a little frustrated they've gone for a partially missing story as opposed to some story that has no episodes in the archive at all, but so be it. To have it, I think it's the last early Troughton story that is not available in some form. I might be wrong on that.
No, that's right. And it's episode 2 that they found, so that's the earliest surviving full episode of his.
Okay, yeah. At some point, whoever picks up this animation project is presumably going to have to venture into the Hartnell era a little more than they have already. I mean, do we know which company is doing it this time? This is nothing to do with Gary Russell's outfit.
That's what I was wondering myself, because the last we heard, we still don't know where the funding came from, because BBC America was funding it, and they pulled out. And so they were like, well, we have to be done with animations for the time being. We don't have money. So yeah. I have no idea how this happened. I haven't seen that pop up yet.
Oh, well, there you are. Let's hope, dear listeners, you're not listening or tuning in to find out some information, deep analysis of the current Doctor Who news, because you ain't getting it from us. But that's not the last piece of Blu-ray news, is it, Drew?
No. I'm so glad that you targeted me for this, because I'm completely unprepared to tell you anything about it.
Superb.
we're getting, what is it? What is it now?
The continued structured professional analysis continues. Yes, this is series 1-4 of the new series. So 2005 through to, I guess it would be 2009.
So that's coming out on Blu-ray, even though it's already come out on Blu-ray?
No, it's coming out as remastered in high definition, which it hasn't been available in. Certainly not in the UK. Anyway, all of this second iteration of Who was recorded in standard definition right up until Planet of the Dead, which was the first high definition episode. And so I guess this is just possibly some shameless marketing, really. It's being released in November, which is when the anniversary is, when presumably there'll be heightened interest from the not we. So again, you'd be good to go out and get them in high definition, I suppose. I've absolutely no idea what kind of version is available on iPlayer or any of the streaming services, but they have been upscaled. So this is truly a remastering into high definition. I'm not certain I'm going to be persuaded to reinvest, but depends, I suppose, on what additional features there are. What I would have really liked was for the new Who to get the same kind of treatment as Classic Who is getting in the collection series, because it would have been
nice.
You
want all the new episodes to be animated? I gotcha. Sure, that makes sense.
Absolutely.
Well, there is one feature that has not been released yet that's going to be on here. I don't know if it's worth buying all four for, but it's a new extra with Russell T. Davies and David Tennant called A Look Back Through Time and Space. But that's it. Everything else has been released already.
I mean, here's the thing. I can go to my local Walmart and get the complete run of Eccleston and Tennant together and Matt Smith and then Capaldi. They all have their own box sets, and it's $20. It's like ridiculous. I already have them, but I think they are just the episodes with no Vam, and of course Vam is the reason that we buy any of this stuff. I'm happy that they're at least giving it this sort of attention, because it means it exists out there and will have better qualities. And when we have Disney Plus, I'm assuming that Disney Plus is going to be running the higher, which is probably how they got this, right? Like, that makes the most sense, is if Disney Plus is going to show it, they want it to be the best possible looking one. So it just seems like that would be the smart move. Also, you know, just getting it out there for the 60th anniversary, well, it's kind of in the news. People will see something new. They'll pick it up. I mean, you know, sure, it's a shameless cash grab, but at the same time, it's nice for folks who care about this kind of stuff. I mean,
absolutely.
Right now, it seems like if you've got any kind of television that was made within the last 5 years, you want to have things that are made in higher definition, because it's just going to look better.
Indeed, yes. Even the Underwater Menace. So,
BBC Books have announced the novelization of the first story of Doctor Who of 2005, Rose, and it's in an illustrated version. It's already been out, came out in 2018, but this one is illustrated from acclaimed artist and former Who and Company guest, Robert Heck.
Former Who and Company guest, is he? Right.
Oops. Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Robert's great. So, yeah, no, his artwork's fantastic. And to have it just get that kind of attention again, it was really nice to see Russell T. Davies post about it and then, you know, specifically name check Robert in that. You know, I mean, I can imagine as a Doctor Who fan and an artist that sort of accolades is going to be. And the other thing, too, I think, is if it sells well, of course, we'll get more of them. Because if it's one of the things that they certainly like, we know with our Doctor Who artists, if your cover of your target novelizations look a certain way down the road, they're probably going to get the same artist or at least a facsimile artist to make it similar. So I'm guessing that this is not going to be the last time that we see Robert's work with Doctor Who.
It sort of looks like the annuals that we used to get.
It does, yeah.
Speaking of, I didn't have this written down, but I just saw it the other day. They're doing another annual this coming season.
It's almost as if they do one every year.
Yeah, and this one is going to have David Tennant and Shuti Gatwa's doctors in it.
Nice.
I seem to recall there was a little bit of controversy either last year or the year before, because I think the Jodie annual didn't have Jodie on the cover. It had somebody else.
And, no.
It was terrible. Whether or not it was actually confected or whether there was like a genuine boob made there, I'm honestly not certain. But yeah, the annuals, certainly the old Doctor Who annuals are very much a tradition, certainly here in the UK. And I will probably end up receiving that at least twice or three times, as I always do, from people who think, oh, I know what to get James for Christmas. Let's get him a Doctor Who annual, because no one else would have thought of that. Hints.
The Doctor Who annuals are the most likely Doctor Who products to be found at our Goodwill thrift stores. Those pop up. Now, the one I want is the 1965 annual that was recently featured in the second season of Good Omens. I'm not sure if either of you have watched that one yet, but the Doctor Who nostalgia for that one, of course, directed by Douglas McKinnon, very strong, very fun. Doctor Who episode director and former guest of Who and Company, Douglas McKinnon.
Yes, this is not an infomercial. Yeah, all right.
Hello and welcome to this episode of
Okay, as I mentioned at the top of the show, Drew and Brent, you have been conventioning again. Now, I did mention this in the latest edition of Once and Future Review, and people seem to be very interested, Drew, in your travel plans and the logistics of you getting from North Carolina to New York, just because I happened to say that you weren't flying. Apparently, this is a big deal. Our listeners, our American listeners, tell me, they've been emailing in to say that why didn't Drew fly? They don't want to know what the convention was like. They want to know why you didn't fly and what was the road trip like.
I didn't want my arms to get tired. Every year I go to Long Island Who, I travel with former Who and Company guests, the gal Nathan Skreslet from Pixel Who, who have a display. So they set up in the dealer's room, and in order to sell their products, it is much cheaper to drive the product there than it is to fly and have it shipped. So we pile into their minivan, and it is a bit of a tight fit, but it is also really nice because I get to spend 10 hours in a car with my friends. And so that's sort of my annual hangout spot, because once we actually get to the convention, I never see them. So that's why we do that. So it's about 2.5 hours from my house to their house, and about 10 hours roughly. Ooh. To get there. But it's...
I could fly to LA passes. From London quicker than that.
But at the same time, you'd probably sit quietly and watch a video and read a book, whereas I sit and I talk with my friends. So I get to have an annual hangout that is just us, almost completely uninterrupted. Stop off, eat some bad food, you know, hit some traffic.
It does sound amazing. It does sound amazing. Having just done around about 1,500 miles when I was in the States in a car, not all at once, but broken up over a period of 2 weeks, I can see the appeal of the road trip. And I think you've gone some way to answering questions received from Marina, Lee, Jarvis, and Martin. So there you go. Who all asked various questions, the same question in various different ways. But anyway, let me ask you something a little bit more, certainly in line with my interests anyway.
No, let's talk about the road trip. It was great. So.
Yeah, okay then. Brent, how did you get there?
I did fly. This was my first time going to Long Island. I've been in New York several times, but this is my first time in Long Island. And so I flew up there. This was my first LI Who.
Right. And just give us a little bit of scene setting. I've been to Gallifrey. It's not since, I think 2013 was the last time I went, but I've been on three occasions. And the very first time I went was actually had quite an intimate feel. The last time I went, which I think was 4 years later, I had a gap in between the second and third time. I went. It had changed, and it had changed to become a massive behemoth of a convention with far too many people sitting in corridors 24/7. So I didn't go again. Now I get the feeling that Ken Deep, who's the lead organizer on this, was very keen to create an intimate kind of atmosphere. But perhaps you can just describe what it's like to hang out at this particular hotel for 2 or 3 days.
I had a great time. This was, like I said, this was my first time. It was nice to see Drew and hang out with Drew for the weekend. Almost as soon as I'd walked in the door, Drew and I ran into Katie Manning, who both gave us, she gave us both a hug and a kiss on the cheek. So that was a nice start. there was a very cool dealer's room that I was in and out of a lot. I got a picture with Paul McGann, who signed it the next day. Had a Sunday afternoon chat with Sasha Dewan, as you do. We did our live show with Malcolm Troughton, which was awesome, out now on Yahoo & Company feeds. And of course, that was a big highlight, but right up there was my photo session with Katie Manning.
Right.
I went in there, she grabbed my hand, and then she had to talk to the photographer for a second and continue to hold my hand. And then we went back to the TARDIS, took a picture. And she gave me a hug, and then she just stared at me in my eyes for a second, and I was like, oh, God, what's happening? And so then I was like, okay, thank you, and I walked away. As I'm walking away, she says, God, I love my job. And so then, like, I walk straight out of the room, and Drew's standing there, and he was like, did you hear what she said? I said, yes, I did. That was awesome.
Well, what did you say? What was it about you? I mean, or did she say this about everyone, or does that completely undermine the experience for
that
you?
Was the first time I had heard that. But so I went down. Drew had an interview with her right after that. Right. So I'm sitting in the lobby waiting for my shuttle bus to go back to the airport. That was the end of my convention. I picked up my picture, my photo with Katie, and I'm looking at it. So I just took a picture and I sent it to Drew. Totally forgot he was interviewing her at the time. I just sent it to him. Hey, look at this. And he sent back, yeah, she just told me that she saw the picture and she was like, oh, yeah, I remember him. He was very handsome. And I was like, oh, my God. And I was like, talk about ego boost. My head was so big, I almost didn't make it out of the double doors of the hotel.
Oh, so that's amazing. Amazing. So Katie Manning clearly had the hots for you, Bram.
Oh, it was a big ego boost. I was very happy.
That's amazing. I mean, I the very first time I think I ever saw Katie Manning interviewed was at Hooverville, which has just had its 14th iteration. The second time it was staged, Tom, formerly from this podcast, and me were there. And Katie Manning obviously felt the same about Tom. So again, sorry, I want you to continue to feel special, but she clearly felt the same. She chased him around the convention, and that was in an old train shed. So again, they were actually repainting. There was this toxic smell of paint throughout the entire entire convention. But yeah, it didn't matter where Tom went, Katie Manning followed, and she was going, isn't he gorgeous? But I mean, there are so many Katie Manning stories, but that sounds amazing. And I think, Brent, you're going to have to post that picture on a DWP Facebook group.
Oh, sure.
But Drew, who alumni chased you around the convention?
You know, the funny thing is, so the way this hotel is set up, there's kind of the main lobby, and there's a hallway in which people congregate and talk and mill about. And then you can go off to separate rooms to have your panel. So there's a main panel room, which is the biggest one, and then it's two smaller ones. And then there's a long hallway where you have your photo shoots. So the guests are constantly moving about, and they're usually at a table. They've got their handlers, and they're signing autographs. But in between the signatures, they're walking around and talking with folks. They're very free with their time. And that's one of the things that I think brings a lot of people to Long Island Who is because there is a very casual and fairly intimate atmosphere about it. I mean, but, you know, like I got to have dinner with Paul McGann a couple times and kind of hang out. And I did get quite a few kind of one-on-one interviews. We'll post one on Who & Company's site with Richard Ashton, and he's already agreed to become a guest. I hadn't seen Gary Russell in a really long time, so he and I sat down for a little while and chatted. Didn't record that one. It was just, you know, like a friendly conversation. As Brent mentioned, I did get a chance to chat with Katie Manning. That won't be on Who & Company, probably because we are talking about a film that she made in the late 80s while she was in Australia called The Quest, which they called Frog Dreaming, or in the UK, you probably would have known it as Go Kids. A film that was very influential to me as a child. So Katie and I talked about that experience. We did both end up crying a little bit. So the photo I have with her is both us kind of red of face and bleary-eyed. But no, we talked about...
Yeah. Did you talk about John Pertwee at all? Not that my priorities are very clear, but...
So this is very important. When I'm interviewing a guest, if it's not specifically for the podcast, I very rarely talk about Doctor Who because they have said it all before. If you want to get energy out of a Doctor Who guest, talk about anything else.
I completely disagree. I think that's a wonderful challenge, is to get new stories and new takes on even if the same story. And that is, again, I've not interviewed for ages now because I made a decision not to do so when we brought the DWP back. But one of the things that I got out of Peter Purvis was new memories when his episode of Galaxy 4 was recovered. And that was... You know, it was gold dust in the making, just talking to him, and it felt it was incredible. I get your perspective entirely, and it is certainly an angle which people don't take usually. So it is good just to get to know them, get the insight into life beyond Who. But anyway, let me just ask a couple of other L.I. Who questions then. Just so, again, to get the context, really, how many attendees are we talking about?
Roughly 500.
Quite small.
It is quite small. And yeah. The other thing, too, is it was a three-day con. It's technically a two-and-a-half-day con. So, you know, roughly 2 o'clock on a Friday and then all day Saturday. And when I say all day, like the Friday ran until 12 o'clock. There was programming at 11. So it's a long con. And then on Saturdays, programming starts at 9 a.m. It goes all the way till 12 o'clock. And then people stay in the lobby and hang out until 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the morning sometimes. Mm-hmm. Sunday, it ends at 6, but then there are still people who hang out until late into the evening. The hotel staff there is very understanding as well. And so they are more than willing to work around the congregation of people dressed up as Cybermen and so forth. But there are people who have one-day passes and there are people who have long weekend passes. And so you don't get all 500 of those people at the same time. So there are folks who are coming in that just can come in for one day. Usually Saturday is the big day, and that's where they try to hit most of the programming. So one of the things we haven't talked about is the programs. So Brent and I both were on panels. We did, of course, our live show. The one-on-one interviews, the main stage usually is you're set for your main interview folks, and then the side rooms will have really amazing discussions. If you want to talk about that, certainly can talk about some of the panels that we were on. They were a really good one. Sunday's a little bit more subdued, so a little bit more like Friday, but because it is early in the morning, you generally get most of your kids on your Saturdays and your Sundays.
Yeah. It's interesting, I think, the way that the US runs conventions compared to the UK, because the panel concept does not translate. You do not get panels over in the UK cons. They did attempt to do that, or the BBC did, for the official celebrations for the 50th anniversary, and it came across as stilted, bit more like something you'd expect to see at San Diego Comic Con, perhaps. But this is very, very American. So I am interested in the fact that it was panel-based. Just talk about them a little. And I know they may well be rudimentary for you, but explain how that works. How do you get on a panel? Who is on a panel? Who leads them? How long are they? And how disciplined, how seriously do the audience take it?
Well, let me just start with the logistics of it. Usually about 3 months prior to the convention, the programming staff will post on their website that they are looking for panel ideas. Now, if you are like me and you've come to this convention for, you know, every year for almost a decade, sometimes you'll get personal invites too. So people will be like, you know, do you have any ideas? I've submitted 10 or 20 ideas every single year, but they will then post all the suggestions that people have added, and then people will sign up on the website to that. So we gauge the interest by who actually participates. So if I, for instance, I think 3 or 4 people suggested collecting Doctor Who memorabilia, so they're not going to have, you know, 3 or 4 of the same topic. So whatever one was better written generally, or whoever's willing to run it, is the one that gets selected. And so a lot of it's based off of people who are like, yeah, I'll sign up for that. And not everyone wants to sign up. A lot of people would much rather be in the audience, but there are folks who, like me, just really enjoy being a panelist. So I will try to sign up to 2 or 3 this year. I think they've got me on 8 or 9, it felt like. in addition to, but I was also willing to moderate, so that's an important job on that one. Your panel size is usually 3 or 4 people, plus a moderator, and a moderator is specifically making sure everyone on the panel gets a chance to talk, that the audience, if they have questions, gets a chance to talk in a moderated setting, so it's not total chaos. And because Long Island is very much a panel-based convention, the people who have been there before understand what it's like to be an audience member in a panel. Really early on at convention experiences, I realized that not everyone gets that. There's a lot of people just randomly talking, or rather than asking a question, they tell stories, which is very common, especially when you have you're interviewing a guest and someone's like, well, let's take questions from the audience. Well, this is less of a question and more of a statement. And then they go ramble on for 5 minutes. And then, you know, everyone just kind of awkwardly says, thank you for that. Okay. And then, yeah. And so because there is panels every single hour, you essentially get 50 minutes to talk. Someone will from the convention will come in to let you know that with a 5 minute warning so that, like, you know, at 5 minutes till it ends and gives everyone enough time to shuffle out and go to the next panel. And most of the panels are in the same hallway, so it's very easy to get from one panel to the next if that's part of your schedule. When I go to a convention, if I'm either going to be in a panel, they give us our name tags. So if you pre-register, you'll get a name tag. And on the name tag, if you're a panelist, it will have the panels, the day and the times for all your panels. So okay. I will be able to look at the back of my name tag and go, oh, I have to be here in a few minutes.
No, that's useful. I mean, you mentioned one that you suggested, Doctor Who merchandise. Phil would have loved that, incidentally. Because I think Phil's house is an entire shrine to Doctor Who merch. And last I heard, his family had to all live in one room now, so he had enough space for his collections. but what else, did you either moderate or get involved in?
Brent, do you want to go with yours first? And I'll
yeah, I did one. I didn't moderate, but I was a panelist on one that I thought I could contribute a lot to. And it was called While You Were Streaming. And it was supposed to be talking about where Doctor Who is streaming now. But the panel was going all the way back to when VHSs were released, and then the DVDs, and then the Blu-rays. But we talked so much about all of that, we barely talked anything about streaming because we ran out of time. We mentioned it a little bit, but it was a fun panel. So yeah, it was a lot of fun. The other two guys, one of them had a lot of, personal memorabilia, like newsletters and different VHS inserts and things like that. Cassettes, things you don't see very often. So that was really cool to see.
That sounds great. And I have to say the panels are the one thing that I really enjoyed. I like the idea that you could be on a panel, you could be moderating, and yeah, you're with a panel with someone who may have been in the show or associated it, and they're not the one who are leading it. So, you know, the fan hierarchy that we often consider or at least are aware of just disappears at Gallifrey, or at least it certainly used to. And I very much enjoyed that. Drew, I must ask you as well, Brent. I mean, what was it like on stage interviewing Michael Trout? And which listeners, you can hear that interview on the Who & Company feed. Just Google that. But do tell me how that one came about. And secondly, how did you find it?
He's a big goof. I mean, and that was a thing. I highly recommend people listen to that interview on Who & Company, mainly because the first thing that starts is him doing a impression of a scratchy LP recording of Woody Woodpecker doing his famous call.
Yes.
I wasn't expecting that. Brent wasn't expecting that. The audience wasn't expecting that. And then he followed that up with the sound of a cat being sick. So if you want to learn the tricks of the trade to disarm your audience and get them on your side, apparently that's what you got to do, because he was nothing but charming the entire time.
Right.
It was an incredibly easy experience. One of the things that is a little tricky when you interview anybody and there's two people is knowing who needs to be talking. Brent and I sat on either side of Michael. And I just, you know, Brent basically would like move the microphone close to his mouth when he wanted to ask a question. It was perfect. It was exactly the way you needed to do it. I think it went off without a hitch. We were very lucky that the individual who set up our audio did so well. And of course, I think we thank him on our podcast as well for that one. But yeah, that it came out, I think, across the board pretty good. I may have gone off the rails a little bit selecting audience members who are wearing hats. And that was a gag that is probably not going to play on podcast as well as it did in the audience, where three people who raised their hands were the only three people wearing hats in the actual auditorium. So when the fourth person came in, we decided to make them wear a hat just to ask the question, which I think...
It sounds like you had a lot of
them
fun.
A bit. Yeah, it was.
Yeah. Which is great. And yeah, I did. I mean, I've listened to this show, and I did wonder what on earth was going on with his stories about Percy Edwards and his various different vocal special effects. But I did put it down to him playing on the slightly weird British stereotype, because I think that probably did come across. But after that, certainly, I think he come across as very natural, and it sounded like you had a great time.
It was a great time. We had a big crowd too.
Yeah,
that was great. The room was pretty much full, and I was a little nervous to start with. I was like, oh man, and I was also thinking about how are Drew and I going to communicate, like he said, about who's going to talk. It just spontaneously happened. We just looked at each other, and I was like, maybe if I raise my microphone, he'll know that I'm about to say something. And he picked up on
lean forward and just say me. Yeah, no, I've not interviewed with anyone else, and I've done quite a number over the years. I've interviewed multiple guests at once. That was quite interesting. Nigel Fairs, Simon Gurrier, and Andrew Smith. Now they all wanted to speak at the same time because they all had various stuff they wanted to sell, but that was quite difficult to moderate. But the best one was with Louise Jameson, and I didn't get nervous either, Drew. However, Louise Jameson, I must have interviewed her about four or five times now on stage. She is incredibly disarming, and she will take the words away from you because she looks at you directly in the eye, and all of a sudden you lose the capability to speak, not even say a single word, and her voice drops an octave onto when she's performing, and it's like bleh, 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 bleh. But I love speaking to her. But
oh my gosh, she's amazing. Yes. She's amazing. Before our interview at I think it was Wholanta, we just ended up dancing with each other just in the it's some of my favorite photos I have from Doctor Who, is someone just took pictures of us kind of waltzing around the room.
wonderful
Very cool. Yeah, Brent mentioned that it was a full area, and it's true, it was for almost every single one of the panels that we did. So I did one on the art of the cold open, so we just talked about like what a good cold open does. Some of our favorites, audience favorites. I lead a lot of positivity panels where we're just not allowed to talk bad about anything. And
oh,
the positivity
I wouldn't like
panel,
that.
No, you would probably hated it. But I think you would have appreciated what we did. We took the DWN's most recent poll a couple years ago and just talked about the bottom 30 and just talked about good things about stuff that fans generally don't like. And this we went through called Standing Up for Whitaker, a positivity panel. We just talked about every single of Jodie's episodes, only good stuff. And it was really good. Like, the audience gets really excited. And the reason we call it Standing Up is some years back, we did a positivity panel, and folks got so excited about saying good things about Fear Her that, and I'm trying to remember who it was. It might have been Jason Miller. Drew Wolko possibly was on that one. Keir Hansen was on that one as well. That we all just started standing up because we wanted to say other good things.
Brilliant. Now, that's superb. I will just jump in and say hello, Drew Wolko. I think Drew has was at all three Gallifreys that I attended, and had breakfast with him on several occasions, and we've maintained contact on Facebook. So yes, I didn't want your name, Drew, the other Drew, not this Drew, to be mentioned without me at least acknowledging that. But please carry on.
I was at that panel that Drew had with the positivity of Whitaker. That was a great panel.
Yeah, that really is good.
I thought you meant David Whittaker initially. I am sorry. I'm just thinking, what's wrong with the Dalek stories? You know,
nothing that Whittaker wrote. So actually, Jason Miller, which Brent had mentioned, and Drew Wolko, and our friend Heather McHale, did one on cliffhangers where they actually got to show cliffhanger, like just the cliffhangers, you know, some of the best, some of the worst, some of the it's one that Jason does every single year, did a great job. We did a 10 years of L.I. Who panel, which they only gave us 30 minutes to do. And I think we had something like 8 people. And we just kind of went around talking about our favorite moments. But the fact that several members of that panel met at Long Island Who and are now married with children was really fun to get. Yeah, yeah. Some of those stories, you know, we had to, and that was one of the things what a moderator has to do is make sure that you're bringing it back to center of focus and making it sure it was appropriate for audiences. Anyway, we did one called 60 for 60. And if you want to hear that one, Jason Miller has a podcast where we had 60 minutes to talk about 60 Doctor Who stories. Everyone came with their top 60 Doctor Who story list. And it very quickly became apparent that we weren't going to have 60 seconds to talk to each one. So we started with 45 seconds to support one particular story. You weren't allowed to repeat anything. And that quickly went to 30 seconds. And then by the end, 20 seconds. So it's just me screaming, dinosaurs in a spaceship. That's all you need to know. But that final list was pretty good. Also ended with Fear Her as the last one, I think, if I'm not mistaken. And then we closed the convention with Doctor Who at 60, celebrating 60 years of adventure, which was one that Sean Lyon, who runs the showrunner for Gallifrey 1, was supposed to run. But sadly, during the convention, California got hit by a hurricane. And so Sean had to leave to take care of that. And as soon as he landed, not only did he get hit by a hurricane, but also had an earthquake. Really tricky thing. We're hoping everything turned out great for Sean. I haven't heard from him since. But that panel, we had Gary Russell, Amanda Ray Prescott, John Peel, Catherine Sullivan, myself. Lee Gao was on that one too. And so that was just talking about, like, just we discussed. Yeah, Sean was supposed to run and moderate that one. I was supposed to be a panelist. But since he turned off, they said, just moderate it. So I didn't have any of Sean's notes about what he wanted to do. So I just did most important, best, and favorite moments in 60 years. And it wasn't just about the show. We talked about fandom. We talked about Big Finish. Helped that Gary Russell was there. And that was really good. And so that kind of closed everything out. But I think it was a pretty feel-good and talk about a full packed house with standing room only. The panels were fantastic. I guess it's one of those things where it was so excited about talking about our own participation, we forgot about the reason that people actually came to Long Island too, and it's not because of Brent and I. The guest lineup for this convention was really quite excellent. And Brent, I mean, it had to be good enough to bring you to the convention for the first time. So why don't you talk a little bit about the guests that we saw?
Well, my main reason for going was Paul McGann. He was a doctor that I had not met yet. Like we said, Katie Manning was there. Sacha Dhawan was there. He was the last one announced, maybe a month or two before the convention started. Michael Troughton. There was also Fraser Hines, who we had FraserCon on Saturday night, which was hilarious. Brian Croucher was there from Blake 7. Also Jan Chappell from Blake 7. Yeah, it was a great lineup, and it was nice to see some of the fans, some of the people, our friends that we hadn't seen in a long time also.
Yeah. I should also say Richard Ashton and Mickey Lewis.
Richard
too,
Ashton, folks, Mickey Lewis, yep.
Yeah, who, you know, like in the costumes doing this stuff and listening to their conversations about what it's like to have been through that process. Very cool.
It does sound good, and it's certainly a convention that I would have considered attending this year. In fact, Michelle and I did talk about it prior to us arranging our individual holidays, and that would have meant that I would have been in the States for about 6 weeks this year, which actually would have been fine by me, although I have to say you do hot temperature a little bit more intensely than the UK, and it was actually quite nice to get back to just a mere 30 degrees, I have to say. So, but it is something that I will consider next year for sure. I do like the smaller conventions slightly more than the big very large ones that become, you can feel quite alone in a very large crowd. And particularly if you've traveled 4,500 miles across the pond to go to. So if you two are going to go again and my attendance doesn't put you off, then you never know. I may well be there towards the end of October next year, which has been confirmed, I believe.
End of August. So that's the thing, too, that we didn't mention about this convention is normally it's held the week before Thanksgiving in the United States in November. But because it was the 60th anniversary, there is always that chance that BBC would have a big event and call the guests back. And so, you know, that would have broken the showrunners. So they held it in August, and it's going to be in August 23rd through the 25th of 2024. So that seemed to work out really well for a lot of people.
Great. Just finally then, before we put this to bed, if you can highlight the thing that you enjoyed the most, it doesn't have to be something brand new. It can be something that you just thoroughly enjoyed or a piece of information that was shared by one of the guests that you've never heard before. What would top your league table there? Brent, let's go to you first.
There was a panel on the Saturday with, an interview really, with Paul McGann. Right in the middle of the interview, they were talking about the 60th anniversary, and the interviewer asked Paul McGann, do you know what tomorrow is? And he said, oh, it's Sylvester McCoy's birthday, and he's going to be 80. And the guy was like, you know what? Maybe we should record a video of that. So he turns on his phone and records everybody singing happy birthday across the entire room. And it ends up on Paul McGann, who blows him a kiss and says, happy birthday, buddy. So the guy was going to send that to Sylvester McCoy. I don't know if we'll ever see it, but...
Oh, I've seen it.
Well, the actual video?
Yeah, they've posted it.
Oh, okay. Well, I know that the panel was recorded, and that's on YouTube, so you can see him recording it.
Brilliant. That does sound like a memorable moment, I must say.
It was very cool.
Yeah. Although I must say, I was incredibly surprised and taken aback when I realized Sylvester McCoy was 80.
Yeah.
You know, that doesn't feel right either, does it? Drew, how about you?
I just want to bounce off of that and just say that in the past, Paul has basically said that Elihu is his favorite Doctor Who convention. And because it's usually in that in November, it's usually around the time of his birthday. So we got into the habit of wishing him a happy birthday. So there was almost always a happy birthday to Paul McGann, because he's been the guest, I think, of five of the eight conventions. For me, obviously, favorite moment was being on stage with Brent and Michael Troughton. That was fantastic. Just a really good experience. It's nice to be on the main stage. It's nice to have a good, I think just generally the attitude of the crowd in general. But there's something I really want to highlight, and something Brenton didn't mention, is that a group of fans independent of the convention came up with this amazing game where the first 100 people to sign up for this convention got a little computer chip in the shape of a Dalek. Every morning, the dad who created this program would put up images along the hotel walls that had QR codes, and the fans could use their phones to scan the QR codes, and it would tell stories, and you could play games on your little computer chip Dalek by pushing buttons. Not very advanced, but you know, you could play it. And the Dalek would learn, and you could plug it into a replica of one of the Blake 7 computers, and it would spit out a piece of tape to tell you how your Dalek was feeling. Similar to the Tamagotchi little pocket pets we used to have in the mid-90s.
Yeah.
But they did this as fans. They didn't tell the convention it was happening. The convention asked them to do it. And just to see the sheer amount of excitement that fans had interacting with that game, I think Brent and I have discussed maybe getting those folks on for a quick interview just to learn a little bit more about that process, because certainly anybody put that much time, effort, and probably, I'm guessing, money into making other fans happy certainly deserves to be celebrated. So,
yeah.
I mean, it was a good convention all around.
Well, it sounds incredible. And it's interesting how you... focus, or both of you have focused on areas that are not immediately obvious as your top moments, and so it's not like the headline panel, it's not dinner with one of the guests. It's something that's at its core creative, and I think that's great. And that's one thing about Doctor Who fans that I think is pretty unique. They are incredibly creative in how they celebrate their fandom, and it's nice that a convention allows them the freedom of expression to demonstrate that. So I think that is an incredibly uplifting and positive note there, Drew. I hope you've noticed that positivity in my commentary there. But listeners, thank you very much for tuning in. We hope you've enjoyed the summary of what it was like to be Long Island Who this year. We will be back fairly soon. Obviously, our release rate over the summer is a little less pacey, a little less frequent than normal, but we have the big DWP quiz coming up fairly soon. Do make certain you check out Who & Company, just because there'll be a whole bunch of extra coverage from LI Who, including, I think I'm right in saying, guys, a number of interviews that you managed to record. They're both nodding. That works on audio. Thanks a lot. But yeah, do make sure you check that out too. And in the meantime, all that remains for me to say is bye for now.
See you next time.
Bye.
That was the Doctor Who podcast with your hosts, James, Drew, and Brent. You can find us at thedoctorwhopodcast.com. If you have any feedback, please send it in to feedback@thedoctorwhopodcast.com. You can also find us on Twitter and Facebook. Thank you for listening, and take care.